Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest, 2-1. A very warm welcome to another edition of Network Europe. Coming up on the program this week, Europe leads the fight against capital punishment.
The death penalty stands at the pinnacle of human rights abuse. If a government can express its power by killing an individual, then it is far more likely, in my view, to also feel it has the power to suppress that person's freedom of speech, to subject them to torture or other cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment.
Will Kosovo go it alone and declare independence? Poland gears up for snap elections. And who is Alexander Roslin?
Alexander Roslin? I don't know.
No, I don't know.
No, I don't know.
We'll have a closer look at Sweden's art icon. All these stories and more coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters. This week, coming to you from Bonn, Germany, I'm Barbara Gruber. Earlier this week, Europe marked the World Anti-Death Penalty Day. However, Poland was the only EU member state to oppose this day against the death penalty, arguing that the subject should be approached in a broader way, to also condemn abortion and euthanasia. At a conference in Lisbon, EU representatives and members of the much broader Council of Europe joined forces to abolish the death penalty and called for a universal moratorium on executions. Deutsche Welle's Alison Roberts in Lisbon has the details.
A mensagem de Lisboa é clara. A justiça apenas se faz quando a execução não é uma opção. Vamos levá-la às cinco partes da Terra e, para começar, às Nações Unidas.
The message from Lisbon is clear, said Portugal's Justice Minister Alberto Costa in his closing remarks. Justice is only done if execution is not an option. He called on those attending the conference to carry that message around the globe. The event was sponsored by the Portuguese Presidency of the European Union, by the European Commission and by the Council of Europe, a much broader organisation than the 27-member EU. Of the Council's 47 members, all have abolished the death penalty except for Russia, which is considering a moratorium. The Council had named October the 10th European Day against the death penalty after a similar move in the EU was blocked by Poland. Like other EU members, Poland has abolished capital punishment, but its Conservative government wanted any such day also to cover abortion and euthanasia. That idea holds no water for those who lobby against the theory and practice of executions. Piers Bannister of Amnesty International told the conference why abolition is so important.
The death penalty stands at the pinnacle of human rights abuse. If a government can express its power by killing an individual, then it is far more likely, in my view, to also feel it has the power to suppress that person's freedom of speech, to subject them to torture or other cruel, inhuman, degrading treatment.
Portugal, which was the first nation to abolish the death penalty 140 years ago, pressed ahead with the conference despite failing to get EU-wide approval for the European Day. It was a high-profile event opened by the Prime Minister, the President of the European Commission and the Secretary-General of the Council of Europe. Poland was not represented, but Russian human rights campaigner Kirill Korotev, who cited the Council of Europe as a factor in stopping his own country from executing people, called on Poles to reconsider the usefulness of the European Day.
It is not enough to abolish death penalty in practice. It is not enough to abolish death penalty in law. We have also to abolish it in people's minds, and it's even more difficult task which we have to face.
The conference ranged far beyond Europe. Speakers included a minister from Senegal, one of several African states to have abolished the death penalty, and a Palestinian-born doctor who, having along with his Bulgarian colleagues escaped execution in Libya thanks to EU intervention, is living proof of Europe's influence. Bianca Jagger, the Council's ambassador against the death penalty, says even the US, which executes more people than any other Western nation, is susceptible to outside opinion.
It has been extremely important in convincing the Supreme Court in the ruling ending the execution of juveniles because they talked about evolving standards of decency, which refer to the fact that the execution of juvenile has almost been abolished in all countries, even those who have the death penalty.
The current debate there about the constitutionality of lethal injection is, she says, further proof of a shift in mood. Even China, while resisting outside pressure, increasingly wants to show it respects rights. In its own way, so does France. On the first European Day against the death penalty, it is set to become the 40th Council of Europe member to ratify a protocol banning the death penalty in all circumstances.
Deutsche Welle's Alison Roberts reporting there. And the United Nations General Assembly is due to discuss the death penalty before the end of the year. Another big topic which is up for discussion at the UN shortly is Kosovo. The Security Council is due to vote on the province's future on December 10th. Russia is expected to veto the UN's autonomy plan for the breakaway Serbian province, and Kosovo says it will declare independence after the December 10 deadline, but Serbia says it won't accept losing its southern province. In the latest round of diplomatic efforts, the Dutch Minister for European Affairs, Frans Timmermans, travelled to the region this week to ease tensions and to try to forge a compromise before a new meeting between Serbs and Kosovars in Brussels on Sunday. Radio Netherlands' Vanessa Mark reports.
It's 6 a.m. and it's a cold, dark morning here at Rotterdam Airport. And the Dutch Minister for European Affairs, Frans Timmermans, is just about to take off for a flying visit through the Balkans. Good morning.
Good morning, Frans Timmermans, Rotterdam Airport.
Mr. Timmermans, where are we going to today?
We're going to first to Slovenia and then we're going to Serbia. We need to talk about Kosovo, but also the future relationship between Serbia and the EU.
The minister's visit to the region comes just ahead of a fresh round of talks between Serbia and Kosovo to try to break the deadlock over the status of the breakaway province. Serbia is against the United Nations plan to grant Kosovo supervised autonomy, and it's got the backing of Russia, which says it will veto the plan when it comes up for a vote at the United Nations Security Council on December the 10th. So what next?
It's difficult for everyone at this stage. Nobody has a panacea for this issue. We'll have to try and work out a solution that will get support in the Security Council and that will also be supported by the parties involved. But don't ask me to come up with the one issue that will solve the problem. There's no one who can give you that today. We will try and influence developments so that the parties involved will also abide by that plan. No contingency planning, no alternatives. We just want this plan to go ahead.
If there's no backing for the United Nations plan, Kosovo says it'll go it alone and declare itself independent unilaterally. That's playing with fire, says the Serbian Foreign Minister Vuk Jeremic.
It would be really dangerous to go and follow unilateral course of action here in the Balkans. We have a very, very bad experience with unilateralism. That's how it all started back in the 90s. Unilateralism brings huge risks. And I think that the international community should be aware of these risks and should really try and work with the parties, both Belgrade and Pristina, and try and discourage everybody from taking unilateral steps. If we make a mistake in this process, then we are going to push backwards the prospects for the European future for all the citizens of the Western Balkans, and we must avoid that.
Well, as Europe frets about the future of Kosovo and Serbia's position on the issue, I've come to the center of the capital, Belgrade, the main high street here, Knez Mihailova, to find out whether people here really care.
Yes, I'm worried about it, and I hope that Kosovo will stay in Serbia.
Why?
Because the Kosovo is part of Serbia a long time, and many people from Serbia live there.
Kosovo is lost for Serbs, because I think that America is actually supporting, yes, Albanians, and Kosovo has some important historical meaning for our countries, but for us young people, it isn't so important.
It's a big shame for us, because it's part of our history and of our country.
Do you think that Serbia should stop them from being independent?
No, they will not. I'm pretty sure about that.
Well, Serbia might not send in the troops if Kosovo does declare itself independent, but international forces are still standing by in their thousands in case of a breakout of violence. The issue could trigger tensions not just in the Balkans, but also within the EU. The EU failed to stop bloodshed in the Balkans before, and it's made it its mission to find a peaceful compromise this time around. But its members still can't agree on just how to do that, and time is running out fast.
Radio Netherlands' Vanessa Mock there, reporting from Belgrade. In a week's time, Poles will be electing a new parliament. Snap elections were called after the Polish government, headed by Jarosław Kaczyński, fell apart in August, following prolonged infighting in the ruling coalition. Polish voters will now have the choice between seven parties, and the race is a tight one as no bloc has a clear lead. So, who are the main players, and how do Poles feel about these elections? Michael Kubicki from the Polish Radio's External Services reports.
Wybory parlamentarne 2007.
The three main contenders in the parliamentary race are the conservative Law and Justice of Prime Minister Kaczyński, the opposition Liberal Civic Platform, and the Lead grouping, a somewhat strange alliance of ex-communists and left-leaning solidarity activists of the 1980s. Marek Borowski, one of its leaders, thinks that his coalition is anything but strange.
This is the coalition of persons who fought in the past against the oppressive regime. From the other side, here are people who changed the political system in Poland, sitting around the round table. Now, when we have the government which neglects democratic rules, we feel that we should act together.
Both the lead coalition of Borowski and former President Kwaśniewski and the main opposition party, the Civic Platform, claim that under the banner of fighting corruption, the conservative government has abused the state apparatus for political purposes. How can one explain, therefore, the ruling party's good prospects for electoral success? Political commentator for the Fakt Daily Łukasz Warzecha says that voters normally don't analyze very deeply what happens in politics. If they see oligarchs being arrested or apprehended by special services, they are happy.
They listen to Jarosław Kaczyński saying that there are no sacred cows in Poland now and everybody can be brought to court for something. And they think, yes, this is our guy, this is a tough guy. This is all about image. And the Law and Justice Party has succeeded in the past 2 years in creating its image as a very tough party, a party that will give us a new clean slate, a state of clean slate.
According to Mariusz Ziomecki of Superstacja Television, Poles will be making a highly important decision in this election.
There is a group that attempts to accelerate Polish accession to the unifying Europe. And there is strong conservative resistance, and both those forces have their political representation. Some of them are looking at the European Union with fear, with hesitation, and are concerned about our national identity, our customs, our way of life. Others dislike the status quo, and they dream of making Poland more like France or Germany.
The conservative Law and Justice and the liberal pro-European Civic Platform are running almost neck and neck in the polls. The lead leftist coalition is in third place, well ahead of all the other parties. Most analysts think, however, that whatever the outcome of the vote, building a stable government coalition may prove as difficult as 2 years ago. For Network Europe, I'm Michał Kubicki in Warsaw.
Another European country that's had big difficulties maintaining a stable coalition government is Romania. With only a thin majority in parliament, the government has been unable to pass much-needed anti-corruption laws. Alarmed by the high levels of corruption, the European Commission on Wednesday threatened to withhold a quarter of the farm aid Romania receives from the European Union. The EU Agriculture Commissioner, Marian Fischer-Boel, gave Bucharest 1 month to root out serious irregularities in its agricultural payment systems or risk losing more than 100 million euros in farm subsidies. Julian Morrison from Radio Romania International reports from Bucharest on the failing anti-corruption fight.
The liberal minority government in Romania has survived a no-confidence vote in parliament, initiated by the Social Democratic Party in the opposition. Everything looking good, democracy is working, one might say. There is, however, a peculiar thing about this vote of no confidence. It didn't pass parliament because some prominent members of the very party that had tabled it deviated from the party line and voted to keep the minority liberal government. One of them is the former president of Romania, Ion Iliescu, and the founding member of the Social Democratic Party. Beyond intestine fighting in the Social Democratic Party, one question arises. Why is the opposition undermining its own actions? And why would the majority of the political parties in Romania want to keep this incompetent and weak government? One answer would be to keep their seats in parliament for as long as possible, because they know nobody will elect them again. And another, more important explanation might be the following. This government, weak and incompetent as it may seem, proves efficient in protecting politicians suspected of high-level corruption. The next day after the no-confidence vote failed in parliament, Liberal Minister of Justice Tudor Chiariu elaborated an emergency ordinance which puts off criminal investigations in the files of all ministers suspected of corruption. Hilariously, among them is the Minister of Justice himself, involved in a corruption scandal around a plot of land in downtown Bucharest. President of Romania, Traian Băsescu, has pointed the finger at the way in which, according to him, the Minister of Justice is doing the best he can to obstruct justice.
Minister Chiariu finds himself in a situation of open conflict of interest. He has elaborated an emergency ordinance by which he bars prosecutors from investigating his own file and the files of his minister colleagues. I can afford to say that the whole government is in conflict with justice. I confess that I have never seen a government defy public opinion so blatantly and work so intensely against public interest and the idea of justice.
What the Minister of Justice did was to amend a law so that it prevents ministers who are suspected of corruption to be prosecuted, and he did that by means of an emergency ordinance. Emil Boc is the leader of the Democratic Party in the opposition. He too accuses the Minister of Justice of trying to protect his own skin and that of his fellow corrupt ministers by this emergency ordinance.
According to the Constitution, if he wants to adopt an emergency ordinance, it must be an emergency situation, something urgent that cannot be postponed and would have irreparable consequences if it were postponed. There is only one emergency here, that of Prime Minister Tăriceanu, saving his minister colleagues from facing justice. The government is protecting its ministers who are suspected of corruption by changing the rules of the game while the game is being played. This confirms the fact that the fight against corruption in Romania has been stalled and corruption sits at the table with the government.
Such is the spectacle put on by Romanian politics ever since we joined the European Union in January this year. There's been only political fighting and no useful action whatsoever. With 6 weeks to go until elections for the European Parliament, things are not looking great. Corruption is rife among top-level politicians across the political spectrum. Romania is now a contributor to the EU budget, but has not managed to spend one penny of the money it receives from the Union. Moreover, it stands good chances of losing even more money, as the EU threatens to activate the safeguard clause on agriculture. For Network Europe, I'm Iulian Murășan in Bucharest.
Now, immigration has been on top of the news in France over the past couple of weeks. A new immigration law is being debated in Parliament that could introduce quotas as well as DNA testing for family members of immigrants coming to France. Amidst these debates and polemics, the Cité de l'Immigration, France's first museum devoted to the history of immigration, opened this week. An opening, but with no big fuss. President Sarkozy wasn't there, he was in Russia, and the immigration minister wasn't there either. RFI's Sarah Elzas has more.
The brand new Cité de l'Immigration is housed in the not-so-brand new Palais de la Porte Dorée, which was built for the 1931 colonial exhibit. Until recently, it housed France's collection of colonial art that's now in another museum across town. You walk up the steps of the Art Deco-style building and you see carvings of stereotyped Africans. It's an eerily beautiful reminder of France's colonial past. The new immigration museum opened Wednesday to the public and to journalists. Paris's socialist mayor showed up. So did the current Minister of Culture, Christine Albanel. Conspicuously absent was France's current immigration minister, Brice Hortefeux. His government is in the midst of trying to get an immigration law passed, parts of which have been contested strongly, like a clause introducing DNA tests for family members joining others in France. The minister, or at least his ministry, is no stranger to controversy with the museum. Hortefeux is actually the new Minister of Immigration and National Identity. When President Nicolas Sarkozy announced the new ministry, 8 historians on the museum's advisory board quit in protest of the name. Nancy Green was one of them.
We quit a position at the museum in order to protest against a different institution, which is the ministry, that had both the terms immigration and national identity in the title, and which seemed to oppose the two, or by linking the two, seemed to imply that national identity is of a very Franco-French nature, whereas immigrants are not part of that. And it was that opposition, in my view, of the two, which makes the ministry and the title of the ministry unacceptable, and that it goes counter to the whole purpose of the museum itself.
We have a civic purpose, you know. That means let all the people know what is our true story, and through this historical truth to change their view on the present situation.
Jacques Toubon is the president of the museum.
In Europe, France was, during the 19th and the 20th century, the only country which was made in big part by immigration. The other European countries, like Britain, Ireland, or Germany, or Spain, or Italy, sent a lot of people in America, north or south, in Australia, New Zealand. And France has a unique history, which is a story made in a big part by immigration.
The museum's permanent collection includes documents, photos, and artifacts of immigration to France from the 19th century onwards. A touchscreen game explains the foreign origins of common French words.
Métis, which means mixed race in French.
Métis.
I think it probably comes from Arabic. Okay, push Arab.
Oh, you lost.
We lost.
You lost. All right, okay. Where is it from?
Métis.
It's from Portugal.
Misturar as cores. Métis.
The current concept of French immigration is very much colored by immigration in the last couple of decades, mostly from former colonies. But in fact, the history stretches back into the 19th century, with European immigrants coming to fill a labor shortage during the Industrial Revolution. Then there was an increase at the start of the 20th century.
During the 20s, after the great depletion of, the deaths of World War I, leads to the signing of agreements with countries like Yugoslavia, but also Italy, Poland, during the interwar period. Then, after World War II, immigration changes direction, and because of decolonization, there will be a large immigration from the former colonies. And that, of course, has marked French immigration history remarkably. At the same time, I sort of see us moving, or France moving, into a post-colonial period now, because there are many immigrants who come from places that are not former colonies, so that they come maybe with less French skills and come simply from farther abroad, and who come for the same reasons everybody has come, because they're looking for jobs and a better life.
The Cité de l'Immigration presents this history in a very positive light, pushing the concept that immigration has been a great benefit to France. That may be exactly what kept the Minister of Immigration and National Identity away, as his new law is intended to curb immigration. The managers of the museum are staying positive, separating their institution from the politics. They say there'll be an official inauguration ceremony later this year. For now, it's just open to the public.
Roast beef.
Roast beef.
Roast beef? What is roast beef?
For Network Europe, this is Sarah Elzis in Paris.
And from France, we head up northeast to Sweden. Most Swedes have a portrait by Alexander Roslin in their wallets. But while his famous portraits live on Swedish banknotes, his name does not. Radio Sweden's Gabi Katz explores the rediscovery of an artist who put unforgettable images on canvas, but who's been forgotten both in Sweden and his adopted country, France.
His name was Alexander Roslin, and he broke the mold. He was no starving artist. At the time of his death in 1793, he was one of the wealthiest artists in Paris. And back home here in Sweden, you had not arrived if you didn't have your image on canvas, courtesy of the great Swedish master. But while those canvases have survived the centuries, Roslin's name has not. What happens if you ask today's Swedes, who was Alexander Roslin?
Alexander Roslin? I don't know.
No.
No idea?
No, no.
Yes, he was a painter. That's about all, yes.
No. I don't know.
No, actually I don't.
No. No, I don't know.
Alexander Roslin is Sweden's forgotten art icon, a title the National Museum in Stockholm is working on changing with their latest exhibition. Curator Magnus Olausson wasn't too surprised that today's man on the street knows so little about this 18th century master.
Well, you know, it partly has to do with the fact that he worked for his whole life in France, of course. Though, I must say that most French are quite ignorant as far as the work of Roslin, because the art dealers during the 20th century were very successful in order to import his work to Sweden. So it should be the opposite, as a matter of fact.
Well, if we look at Roslin in a wider context of art history in Europe, where would you place him?
Well, he's certainly a representative for the French aristocratic portrait. His great success wouldn't be possible without having adopting the French-style aristocratic portrait of the Rococo and early neoclassic period. You can look upon him as a complete, full-fledged French painter of the second half of the 18th century.
In my wallet at the moment, I have a 100 kroner note, and thankfully, this is one of the occasions where I won't have to part company with it, because we are standing right in front of the real deal, perhaps one of this country's most recognized portraits that we carry around with us every day here.
Yes, that's right. It's a great Carl Linnaeus, the mega star of the 18th century from Sweden. And of course, Roslin was quite well aware of the fact that part of the fame of Linnaeus would create his own fame as an artist. And he brought it to Paris after having painted Linnaeus here in Sweden. And he also, as a sort of advertising, he made an engraving of the portrait that was sold at the same time at the Salon of 1779.
If you look at the portrait with us through your eyes, what can you tell us?
It's certainly a kind of apotheosis in honor of Linnaeus, but still it gives you, I think, a good idea of his character, of the sitter. His gentle eyes still looking on us. And of course, as for the accessories, it's just the badge of the order of the being a knight of the polar star that's visible, and his own Linnea, the flower that was named after himself, Linnaeus, Linnea. It's a very nice portrait of a great character and a megastar of the 18th century.
And a little dusted powder from his wig, perhaps, on
yes.
The shoulder there?
It's quite typical for Roslin's complete illusionistic work. I mean, his great capability as a painter of an almost photographic ability to describe details. I mean, to create a complete illusion and likeness, of course. Ressemblance, as it's called in French.
And Magnus Olausson, one final highlight from the exhibition, which spans three exhibition halls here at the National Museum in Stockholm, The Lady with the Veil.
Yes, that's the portrait of his wife from the late 1760s, and it was already a great success when it was shown at the Salon in 1769. The great success has to do with its mysterious character. It's a lady who attracts, and at the same time, she says to us that she's not interested in having any contact. I mean, she comes close, and then she went into her own mysterious world again.
Roselyne's wife peeping out from behind the veil and a fan, but the canvas, I notice, is very smooth. You almost can't see the brush strokes.
No, he really succeeds in creating a complete illusion. Of course, this is one of the icons of the National Museum, is our own Mona Lisa.
Gabby Katz with this report on Alexander Roslin. And next time you're in Sweden, have a closer look at those banknotes. We have no money to give away, but other goodies. Here's our October quiz. At the beginning of the 20th century, a dancer called Mata Hari was the star of the clubs and soirees in Paris. Her seductive performances and exotic background captivated audiences.
I was born in the holy city of Javnapatam. My father was a highly regarded Brahmin, my mother a temple dancer who died when giving birth to me at the age of 14. I grew up as a charge of the temple priests. They consecrated me to Shiva, and I was introduced to the holy mysteries of love and divine worship.
But Mata Hari was not what she seemed. Her real name was Margarete Zelle, and she was born in the Netherlands, not the Far East. During World War I, she took on another role, that of spy of the German Secret Service. But her luck ran out. On October 15, 1917, Mata Hari was executed after being exposed by French counterintelligence.
I will look the soldiers in the eye. I'm proud of my past, and I was never a spy. I was Mata Hari.
The name Mata Hari means sun, but in which language? You can email us your answer. The address is contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. Or write to us via snail mail at the European Desk, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn, Germany. Or check our webpage at www.networkeurope.org.
Konnichiwa.
Guten Tag.
こんばんは.
Guten Abend.
はじめまして.
Well, that's not the language we're looking for, and you probably recognize that as Japanese. This new language course has just been published as part of a new double CD entitled Poptastic Conversation. Along with the language course, there's a compilation album of German bands singing their songs in Japanese. Here's the band Wir sind Helden and their song Saite Mio. On behalf of the entire Network Europe team, I'm Barbara Gruber saying goodbye, sayonara, and thanks for tuning in.
馬鹿げた思いがふと呼びる。